What would it be like to grapple with stereotypes and historical trauma, all while trying to find your true identity? Try to imagine the courage of a little girl in kindergarten, eagerly raising her hand on Columbus Day to claim her Native American heritage and protest the celebration of Columbus. Then, what would it feel like to you to be told by your teacher that you are not Native American because you were perceived as the Korean in the primarily white classroom? Hi, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Imagine Jaden Lim's real-life experiences. Stay with me to hear her story and why she is now a youth activist demanding that we move beyond the headdress. And she's not referring to the headdress that is meaningful to the Plains and other tribal communities. She's talking about the white man's interpretation of the headdress as a savage and uncivilized representation of Native peoples. Our guest for this next hour is, in fact, a young woman named Jaden Lim. She is a youth activist and California Indian Museum and Cultural Center's tribal youth ambassador. Our team had the pleasure of hearing Jaden. And Jaden, thanks so much for joining us. You inspired us. You made us want to stand up and cheer. I think you took all of our breath away. First of all, you're 17 years old, and you're talking to several thousand people that really know they're there because they know a lot about these issues, and you didn't miss a beat. So, you know, we were writing up on the Bioneers Handbook and saying, we've got to get her. We've got to get her, because there were two of us. There were three of us there.
Thank
so,
you.
Well, it's really important. So, I'd like to start with setting the stage for our time together by actually sharing some of the incidents that you shared with thousands of us at Bioneers that were experiences you had with racism and stereotypes starting at the very young age in kindergarten, because you told some pretty powerful stories to get our attention. This happened to me, Jaden Lim, so share away.
Yeah, I think that it's really important that whenever I do give a speech, I always start it off with a story, because I feel like, one, it gives the impression that my experience with racism and the encounters that I've had are just one in a million of Native kids across California. And then also it makes it more real for the audience to hear that me, as a five-year-old, was being told that I wasn't Native American because I looked Asian, or that I should just go live in a teepee, or I was poor because I was Native. And there was a lot of misconceptions that I had to face at a really early age, and a lot of things that I had to watch. Like, I went to Costco with my grandpa, and we were walking through Costco and just getting our usual groceries, and we hear a man, and this man turns to his friend and he says, "Man, wouldn't it be awful if you were married to an Indian?"
Oh my God.
My grandpa turns around and taps on his shoulder, and he says, "Well, my wife doesn't mind it."
Good for him. It's like, you know, if you're me and come from the place that I do, things like that are unreal. They're like unconscionable. And you just wonder, where does that person come from? Where do they live in their headspace? But it's a perfect segue, because you had, you stood up in kindergarten. That is not typical reaction from a five-year-old. And you said, okay, I'm calling out the inherently racist celebration of Columbus. I'd like to roll it back a little more and talk about, what kind of foundation did you have, like from your parents or your grandparents? What were they doing that gave you that courage and the presence of mind to call it out for what it is?
So, I always like to say that I grew up in a museum, meaning that I was born in 2001. So in 2000, my whole family relocated from a building that they had in San Francisco, where the California Indian Museum and Cultural Center originally was. It was in the Presidio, and they moved it to Sonoma County, which is where they all lived. So it was more accessible. And so when I was born in 2001, I was raised in a museum. I spent all of my time after school before school, on the weekends, in the museum, running around through the exhibits, helping my family put together events and all sorts of stuff. So I think that being around a museum and always being questioned about who I was as a Native person, along with all of the people that are displayed in the museum, it was easier for me to make quick responses. I think that we have a lot of incidents in our museum, actually, where people come in and they're trying to donate arrowheads, or they're trying to donate owl feathers, which is essentially bad luck. Owls are bad luck in my tribe. And so there's like a lot of like weird questions that we get asked, like, I thought Native American people were all dead. There's questions like, Ishii was the last wild Indian, because we have an exhibit on Ishii in here. And so I think that growing up in that type of environment motivated me to start thinking quickly and speaking quickly.
You were getting ready. you were getting ready even in kindergarten.
Yeah, and just not being afraid to stand up to people who may have been older than me.
Right.
Because all of my experiences where I was like racially targeted was because of my teachers or older people that weren't necessarily my peers and people who were supposed to be my elders. And I think that by growing up in this type of environment that I grew up in, I had to understand that being young doesn't mean that you're unknowledgeable.
Right. And that you have a voice and you used it. So it's a lot of things going on there. And tell us about the incident at the White House, because sometimes, I don't know how often, but you're taking a stand, it has a backlash on you. And you have to take the consequences of your voice being out there. So what happened with the White House and Michelle Obama?
Yeah, so I went to the White House in November of 2016, right after the 2016 presidential election. And but I was asked to speak, I think they contacted me in September of that year. And they asked me a few months ahead, and because they wanted me to submit my speech before I spoke it so that they could approve it.
Right, right.
Which, it's the White House, so I understood. So I wrote
They've got to be careful, yes.
Yeah. I wrote my speech, and I waited a few hours, and then a few hours went by, and they had emailed me, and I opened it, and my speech had all been redlined and highlighted and noted. And I was reading the notes and reading what they tried to cross out of my speech and what they wanted me to delete. And it was everything that acknowledged the war of extermination that occurred in California, where 300 massacres happened and millions of people were killed. And they didn't want me to acknowledge the genocide that happened in the United States concerning Native people. They said that it was too depressing, too sad, and they wanted me to focus on storytelling and singing songs.
OMG.
So, yeah.
So now you have me speechless.
So they wanted me to be the happy Indian singing, talking to animals, super mystical. That's what they wanted out of me. That's what they wanted in my speech. And so I did add a Native American story that I've been told throughout my childhood, which is one that's really special to me. And I included that in my speech to satisfy them on that part. But I had to rewrite my speech three times until they stopped redlining it. And so I took my original draft, and then I took my approved draft. And I went to the White House with two of my speeches in my backpack, and I kept reading both of them back and forth on the airplane. And I couldn't decide which one I was going to speak because my mom was encouraging me to speak my mind. This is your one opportunity.
Right, right.
Take it. And so but I was also scared about the consequences. And because I idolized Michelle Obama, I was like, what is Michelle going to think if she doesn't like my speech? Right. And so when I got to the White House, I had to do a dress rehearsal. And so I did a dress rehearsal with my approved speech. And then at the last minute, when they called me on stage for the actual final ceremony, I went back to my original speech.
Wow. You are kidding me. And what happened?
PR people, their eyes got wide and their mouths got large. And Michelle was just sitting there. Her chair was directly in front of the podium. So it was almost like we were having a conversation.
Right, right.
And it felt really personal, and it meant a lot to me to have Michelle right in front of the podium, just staring directly at me. And she actually was talking to me while I was giving my speech, because she was mouthing words at me. And she was trying to tell me that, like, you're making me cry, like, you're so empowering. And she was just like complimenting me as I was giving my speech. And I was trying to read my speech, but also read what she was saying. And I got the opportunity to talk to her twice. So before the actual ceremony happened, all the people who were speaking or performing during the ceremony had the chance to meet her directly in a private room before anyone else got to meet her.
Right.
And
right.
So I think meeting her that first time before I went on to give my speech in the ceremony really was the shifting point
right,
for me.
Right. It gave you the courage to do what you, from my perspective, is do the right thing. It's not a PR move. It's the truth. And I don't know her personally. I know that I got to go to the White House and be at the State of the Kids dinner and just absolutely stood in awe of her and her presence and, you know, reading her book. I'm pretty sure she had your back.
If the Obamas have the power and the courage to acknowledge slavery at the status that they're at, she would, I knew that she would 100% support me in acknowledging the war of extermination and genocide in the United States.
Which has to be done as a part of the healing.
Exactly. Acknowledgement is the first and largest step in fighting the battle.
And I love that you said that. And we had another guest, a wonderful, powerful guest. I told you about him a little bit before we went on the air, Xavier Ramey, and he did a podcast with me called Justice Informed. And he threw me off my game because he asked some pretty tough questions and asked me to go deeper. I loved it because, you know, I felt in control of the microphone and my head, but he did the work, and it is. Acknowledgement is key. We can't just like move on and start making things better. Acknowledgement and forgiveness. So your speech at Bioneers was entitled My Culture Is Not a Costume, and you asked all of us to move beyond the headdress. Talk about what you wanted us to think about, not then, but here, to all of our listeners and the takeaway from that. What does moving beyond the headdress look like? What does that mean?
Yeah, so every time I write a speech, we all sit in the museum and we all get in one room, and it's probably usually around like 5 to 10 people helping me write my speech, because I always feel like there's so much to talk about and there's so much to acknowledge, and I usually have about 5 to 10 minutes.
Right.
Every speech. So I have like the museum that I work at is a family run business. So everyone who works here is related to me.
And so that's good.
Yeah, it's great. But we all get in one room and we brainstorm, and it's helpful because we all come from the same bloodline and we all have the same and similar stories about our ancestors and acknowledging that. But the one who thought about the title Beyond the Headdress was my aunt. And she was trying to get me to come up with a title myself. And I think it was like almost like leaving like little treats for me until I got to the finish line. And so she was trying to get me to come to this conclusion that, like, beyond the headdress has to be the major point. And so what it means to me, I feel like beyond the headdress can mean things to different people.
Right.
But, and that's why I enjoyed it so much, because it's almost like a universal, and people can mold it however they want and to fit their life and their scheme of things. But for me, it meant that I had this incident in fifth grade, and we had this Native American fair, and all the kids in my class picked a Native American region, and they had to dress up as if they are a Native person from that region, and then do one of those tri-fold poster boards and do a report on that region of Native American people. And I chose California, of course, and I dressed up in, I didn't think it was appropriate to dress up in my regalia, which is my traditional wear, but I created like a shawl with like abalone shells, and my mom helped me make the whole thing. We spent days on it, making tulle skirts and stuff. And, but when the fair came around, all of the kids went to the little boy in the massive headdress. They wow. weren't, they weren't visiting the, I mean, authentic, real Native American in the class, hence me, but they were attracted to the stereotype that they believed was Native American, which was the huge, massive headdress and the buckskin and the feathers and all of that stuff is what children and adults perceive as Native American. That's their mold. That's their stereotype. It's almost set in stone. And so when I think about that incident where I stood with my poster and my traditional wear, and I watch all of the kids hustle to the kid in the headdress, I think about it's time that we move beyond that point.
Headdress, right.
Beyond,
right.
Beyond where we think that a headdress. Because the headdress and Native American people were also labeled as savage and uncivilized and bloodthirsty, but they're also imagined as docile, and they simply are sheep in a herd. And there's so many negative stereotypes about Native American people, either where they're dumb or they're portrayed as sex objects or they're bloodthirsty or they're the stoic brave, but they're never just a person. They're never just a person capable of multiple things rather than being confined to one particular characteristic.
Right.
And
right,
I think it's right. time that we go beyond defining a race of people by such few little boxes.
And the other thing is that when you go a little bit deeper into this, the Native aspect of it, it isn't like there's one culture. Each one of the cultures are unique and different and have different tribal customs and beliefs and sacredness about them and different stories. So I was the head of the refugee program for the state of Arizona, and people called the people that I was working with Southeast Asians. Well, there isn't any such thing. There's Vietnamese, there are Cambodians, there are Laotians, and they're all different, and they speak different languages and all that. So lumping it in, even though it's not always consciously mean-spirited, you have to be conscious and realize that that's just putting everyone in one basket, like saying all white people. That's not true either. So let's go on to, I know that you agree with me, and I agree with you that stories are powerful. And for the most part, when I was preparing for this, the stories about Native people are mostly false ones. They're what people see in the movies, as you said, even in the history books, which is supposed to be, you know, the written word according to history, which is BS. In most cases, I believe they're distorted, in many cases false. So you talk about the false narrative in your speech. How do we even begin to change the false narrative? Like for you, Jaden Lim, where do you want the narrative to begin to stop the false narrative? Can you break it up into a couple of steps?
Yeah. So I think stereotypes are rooted in misinformation concerning history.
Right.
So, I mean, for example, the headdress is a result of Native American people all being the same. And that's a common misconception. Or Pocahontas, that's another huge misconception and factually incorrect. And the way that Disney portrays her as like this, like, lanky, like, sex object. And
the long brown hair and big brown eyes. Yeah. And yeah, it's actually a total makeup, made up.
Everybody at my office was researching it. And the Disney character in Pocahontas was modeled after Filipino woman.
Oh, God. I'm sorry I'm laughing, but it's like, wow.
I mean,
talk about distorted.
Yeah. So, and then you start to look at the character more and then you see, wow, she really does look pretty Asian. So I think that there's a few steps and I probably have to think more about the order in which they should occur. But one of them is the dismantling of stereotypes, not putting Native American people in a box or telling them that they have to define their identity a certain way, because that's really troubling for youth, especially with the results of historical trauma. And so, but stereotypes are rooted in history. So then we also have to acknowledge the factually incorrect history that's displayed in fourth grade through high school. And then we also have to utilize media, because media is also a huge portion of stereotypes in how this information is distributed so rapidly.
Yeah, and I agree. It's like you can't have one starting point. It has to come at it from so many multiple angles. And pioneers, they gave you a platform for people that are already, I call them like in the tribe, in the sense of we all come from tribes. But you gave us, we're there because we care already. So we're kind of in the house, as I say. But you invited us to think a little bit deeper, go a little bit deeper, and be careful around languaging and the false narrative and calling it out. So to me, those things are important too, to get your voice be heard. So I'd like to read a quote from your speech. "The history of California is gruesome and cruel, yet Native American people were able to endure multiple waves of genocide while still cultivating their connection in culture. Native American people's existence today is resistance in itself." So what is your assessment as to where Native people stand today? Are you making substantive progress? And that line stuck out for me so much. It's a miracle with all the efforts to literally exterminate. It was a genocide, exterminate, get rid of these people platform. Millions of dollars were spent on it. I think I read there it would be like $446 million or something to do what they did. To the government was paying, by the way. So
yeah.
Where are you today? You know, are your rights still being stamped on? And let me answer from my perspective, because it's safe space and I have to get it out of me. But from what I see, yes, there's some progress, but your rights are still being stomped on. Big money, big companies stomp all over your rights every day on your sacred land. Many Native people still live in something called a reservation. In my state, many of them live without clean water and electricity. I've done stories on that. I'm like, how can this be that there's a group of people in the state of Arizona that don't have electricity and water? They have to go pick up their water. So as we, as a nation, and I know, Jaden, it sounded like such a rant on my part, but I do that occasionally, but how are we doing as a nation in terms of our evolution to right some of these wrongs? Do you see progress? Does your family see progress?
I think that I see progress, not as much progress as I would like, but I see it. I think that our rights, yeah, they're being stomped on. But a really big part of the way that the rights are impacted and how they can, how progress can occur is through a social standpoint. Because the social movement is so negative and society views Native American people so negatively. I see progress, but not as much progress as I would like. But the laws aren't necessarily, the laws are impacted by societal views. Societal views currently are very poor concerning Native American people. How are the laws going to change rapidly and progressively if society's not going to, or if society's not willing to? So we have to start with education and working with society and to change those views about Native American people so that there'll be more progress when we come into the courts, when we come into the White House, when we come into the Capitol, because we need a wide acceptance and a lot of support to get laws passed.
And you hit on rather it. Yeah. I don't mean to interrupt. Go ahead. But you hit on some of those intersections or those places where there's a way to access change. And I think policy is a big one. And, you know, one of the things that I've talked about with people was the whole thing with the Keystone Pipeline, Keystone XL activists. And even though I feel we lost, what happened is the media did cover it and we were able to delay things. And there was progress in terms of elevating the conversation. So to me, I counted that as a small step forward. People cared. And a lot of alliances were formed that are still in place. And there's power in partnerships and alliances. So to me, that was one example where it is. But a lot of the things that are happening are what I think they're insidious. Like, they're in textbooks. How do you change that? People getting dressed up for Halloween with headdresses on. How do you change that? And boy, can that come back to bite you, as we're finding out with someone that painted their face black in their high school yearbook. So there are things that I see as change, but man, they are baby steps.
Yeah. I mean, growing up and having a mom that was the executive director of a California Indian Museum, my mom was previous, or she still is a lawyer, but she doesn't practice anymore. But she went to law school, and then she became the executive director of a museum. And people commonly ask her, how can you be a lawyer and go to school all your life with the intent of being a lawyer and then become the executive director of a museum?
Right, right.
But ever since I could barely walk and have little understanding of what she was saying, she always told me that her job was to change problems in the classroom before they reach the courtroom.
Wow. That's a quotable quote. And I think our social media team will pick that up and say, oh my God, it's so true. But it's so true. Start at the root of the problem. And then you're not having to fight stereotypes down the road. So that's wise mother. Wise mother. Kudos
wise
to
mother.
Wise mother. That's for sure. High five and beyond for that. So I just want to weave into the conversation a little bit. To me, you cannot have a socially just world, a sustainable planet, without a socially just one. It's part of all of our conversation at Mrs. Green's World. So where do you weigh in, or is it on your radar, about the impact on Native people, on marginalized communities, on, you know, the impact of climate change? It hits the underserved or the minority populations first and hardest, and It's really killing people. Nobody seems to get that. But when you look at what's going on up in Alaska with the Inuit, their habitat's disappearing. I mean, where they live is literally melting. And their hunting grounds, it's all shifting. So the reindeer are moving. And they just can't pick up and move and buy a house in Bel Air. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So what about the conversation in terms of climate change?
So the way that I think about it is that I live in Sonoma County, and I've had generations and generations of my people have lived in the same exact city that I do. And they've raised their children. My great, 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 great grandmother was raised here. And that's some serious legacy and lineage. And you think about that, and then you think about the spiritual connection that Native people have to their land, how they have such strong ties because all of their family and all of their ancestors have lived exactly where they're living. And you can't ever imagine leaving. You can't leave that. And Native American people are such a pillar in the ecosystem.
Right, right.
Of their native lands. And so you think about how in Sonoma County, it was about a year ago now, there was a huge fire called the Tubbs Fire. And many houses were burnt down, many properties were destroyed. And you think about that, and then you think about why did that not happen when Native people lived here?
Because great point.
Because
great point.
They conducted controlled fires, which would keep the brush down, and when a fire would get started, it wouldn't spread because all the brush would be removed, creating healthier and more substantial plants to later pick from and live off of. So then when you don't practice controlled fires for a few centuries, you're going to have a huge fire that's going to be extremely destructive, like the one that we experienced.
So, and don't we know it? There's just like living proof. It's just observation that's proof. We had a 563,000 acre fire in Arizona, and our cabin burned, and the fire was fierce and burned for days. And when it came over one of the mountains, guess where it laid down? You can guess. It's not a quiz. It's like it laid down where the reservation land was.
Yeah.
Because of being good stewards of the land, and they did control burns. And it's not shame, blame, or guilt, because the Forest Service has its own challenges with budgets and all of that. But that's what happened. So it's a perfect example.
Yeah. Native American people know how to tend to their plants, their land. They also know how to tend to their animals. There's a zero waste policy. I mean, Native Americans are pillars in their ecosystems. And so when the ecosystem is being impacted negatively, they can feel that.
Right, right. Because they're connected to the land.
Exactly. Like,
yeah.
So the destruction of sacred sites and areas where we have even more meaningful connections to, that's a large problem.
Yeah, and it's got to be, it's very interesting. You're giving me pause and food for thought, because the Native people are living the way that we should live so that there isn't the overconsumption, the abuse of all of the things that nature provides. They're not out talking about climate change. They're living in harmony with the earth. And if everybody had done that, folks, we wouldn't be where we are today. So really good point, Jaden, at 17 years old. And I just was biting my tongue when you talked about how many generations of your family lived on that land. And I was going to say, and I will say it, you mean they were there before Columbus discovered America? I guess that wouldn't be a celebration. It just blows my mind. And as I said to you, when I was a kid, to me, Columbus Day was a great day, and we had the day off. So that's what I cared about when I was 12. You were thinking about other things when you were 12. So one thing that struck me at Bioneers as well was the incredible strong presence of young people taking center stage in many ways. Your voices were being heard. They are being heard. From your view, can we look to the youth of our country to help us take some giant steps when it comes to racism an inequity that still runs rampant in our country. Do you have hope in your peers to bring about a more sustainable and socially just planet? Are you feeling the hope?
I am feeling the hope.
But there's a pause there.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely 100% trust my peers and trust that youth should have a role in changing the country, and they eventually will. But I don't think that they're going to get that for a while.
Yeah, it's like I said to you, things are not accelerating at a speed where I'm going to get see enough of the substantive changes that I want to bring about. When you looked at the, I personally did not look at the State of the Union, but I looked at some of the things afterwards, and just seeing the number of women and women of color, the diversity of women that got elected, it made me think it is our time, and it's going to happen, and maybe it will be accelerated because of the phenomenon of the 2018 election. And hopefully from the work that people are doing for the 2020 census, which will form our country for the next 10 years. So those are things that I have to hold on to for a shred of hope. So so going a little bit deeper again, what are your plans for our country?
For you,
in terms of your leadership, will we be seeing, will I live long enough to see you taking up a Senate seat, or where do you see your voice being used most effectively and impactfully to keep us moving in the right direction? Obviously, you got a young start. It started in when you're in kindergarten, but it keeps being amplified, and I certainly don't want to make light of that. I mean, you touched us deeply. There were thousands of us listening to what you said, and you got to us. You made us think. You created that space where people wanted to go deeper. Again, you weren't speaking at the Republican National Convention, and not to make it political, I don't mean that in any way, but you were with the people that are living consciously, or they wouldn't have been at Bioneers. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
So what are your dreams to help amplify your voice and move it forward?
My dreams are all over the place, to be quite
That's
honest.
Where they should be at 17. Great answer. Really, I mean, and truly great answer. You're exploring and keeping on doing at the same time.
I mean, I think that politics are extremely consistent throughout my life and have been growing up in the family that I've grown up in. But I do feel a lot of pressure to go into politics, considering what I've already done and my involvement in different bills and lobbying. And I recently helped with the Youth Reinvestment Fund to get money for youth to stop the school-to-prison pipeline. And that was a big project that I was fortunate enough to be a part of. And so I think that politics are really consistent. It makes me feel really powerful in my abilities to make a change. And I think that's a really awesome feeling to have at the age that I'm at. But I mean, I also have my dreams of pursuing music and doing other things and being a writer, and dreams that I've had since I was little, and being solely creative rather than a creative problem solver.
But you gave the best answer. I wanted to like do the happy dance, because at 17, you're still growing, you're taking things in, you're exploring, and yet you are still letting your voice be heard. So you're having an impact, and you know, one of my expressions is wherever you go, there you are, and you're showing up wherever you are with that same voice, that same passion, and that same consciousness to make a difference. So to me, whatever path you take, you'll have a ripple effect because of what you're here to do, which is make a difference. So I'm not going to be worried about you, kiddo. I can tell you that. It's like whatever you do, you'll be there and you'll be making a difference for the lives that you touch. So I don't know if you can answer this, and I don't usually like to ask this question, to be honest. So that's fair on my part. But if there was one message that you wanted us to take away from this conversation, a thought that you might want to leave us all with in terms of how we can be a part of the solution. Do you have that answer?
Yeah, I think I do. I think that the key points within this conversation was the importance of education and the importance of empowerment and the importance of uplifting our youth and being aware of our surroundings. I mean, it's really important to be societally aware and aware of society's constraints and how they affect individuals and people all across the world and how they may affect your point of view on certain matters that you don't even really understand. And to combat that, it's important to educate yourself and others and be an advocate for those who need it.
Right. Wow. We can't improve on that message, kiddo. That's all I can tell you. So I want to thank you. I want to forward promote the next two shows that we have. Our local show on March 7th is Peter Dorlin and Chris Kopak from the University of Arizona, celebrating partners in sustainability, another Tucson Electric Power Brightee Award winning program. And then on March 12th, Zen Honeycutt, the founding executive director of Moms Across America, Health, Freedom, and the Future of America, another person I met at Bioneers. And here's my last words from Mrs. Green. In our world, we believe that we can never have a sustainable planet without a socially just one. Jaden Lim has opened her heart to us, shared her real life experiences, and hopefully has challenged all of us to think a bit more deeply about where we stand on being disruptors for good when it comes to the ugly face of racism, whether intentional or not. Our recent show guest, Xavier Rami from Justice Informed, used a quote from Cornel West, a professor of the practice of public philosophy at Harvard University, in his interview with me that stuck to me. It stuck with me. Never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. It begs the question, what do we as a nation look like in public? I, for one, am all for working to look more like love. Thanks for being a part of our world. And Jaden Lim, thanks for entering my world, because my world is better because you showed up in it. So thank you for taking the time, and we'll be watching. And no pressure, take the path that brings you joy and happiness, because I'm sure you know that's the most important one. So thank you for all you do and for taking the time and being on Mrs. Green's World.
Thank you for having me.
It was great. Thanks, everybody.